We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpath. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who share how meditation and mindfulness practices change our lives. Our podcast is brought to you by Meditation Studio, Apple's pick as one of the 10 best apps of the year. Why download the app? Because life is messy. We get stressed, anxious, have trouble sleeping, work too hard, feel overwhelmed, we grieve, get our hearts broken, worry about the state of the world. We meditate because we're human. Our app gives you more than 200 meditations from 30 leading teachers. It helps a lot. And your one-time purchase of the app helps to keep our podcast going. Give it a try. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. We love having you with us. Today, I interview Sharon Guskin. Sharon wrote the international bestseller, The Forgetting Time. The story is about a four-year-old boy who remembers his past life very vividly and actually keeps telling his mom he wants to go home. The problem is, he is home. While writing this book, Sharon worked with leading experts from the University of Virginia who shared their pretty astounding findings on reincarnation. The book triggered thousands of discussions on the topic. Sharon meditates regularly, considers herself a Buddhist, and shares some pretty compelling evidence on why we might want to think about reincarnation. A quote from her website: "What happens to us after we die? What happens before we are born? At once a riveting mystery and a testament to the profound connection between a child and parent, The Forgetting Time will lead you to reevaluate everything you believe." I hope you enjoy this interview with author and Brooklyn mom, Sharon Guskin. Sharon, I am so happy to have you on Untangle today. I loved your book.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to me, I have to say.
So I want, for those people in our audience that have not yet read The Forgetting Time, before we get going, can you give us a synopsis of what the book is about, just to set a context for our interview today?
Sure, absolutely. The Forgetting Time is about a single mom in Brooklyn who seems to have a rather large problem in that her four-year-old son, Noah, keeps sort of asking for his other mother and saying, "I want to go home." And he seems, he's asking in this very urgent, kind of traumatized way. I want to go home. Where's my other mother? When can I see my other mother? And as far as his mom knows, she's his only mother. She just doesn't know that there's anybody else in the picture. And so this becomes more and more difficult as Noah's having difficulties at school and sort of problems at home and phobias that are popping up around this. And so eventually, kind of out of desperation, this mom, Janie, ends up soliciting the help of this professor who's based on a real guy And the professor's field is that he studies very young children who seem to have memories from previous lifetimes. In the course of the novel, the mother, who is this rather skeptical woman, takes this journey with the professor in order to help her son to try to find this other mother and this other family that he seems to want so desperately.
It's hard to give a synopsis of this book and have this conversation without giving things away, but let's try. So you talk about memories from previous lifetimes. Like, what was your inspiration for wanting to write a novel, a piece of fiction about memories from previous lifetimes?
You know, it's interesting. I have always been kind of drawn to the idea of what happens when you die. Particularly, I worked for a while at a hospice as a volunteer, and it really became very, very present for me. I was like, oh, like, this is a big question. What happens when you die? This is like a serious question for everybody. And around this time, my stepmom actually handed me this book called Old Souls by a former Washington Post reporter. In the book, the reporter followed this guy, Dr. Ian Stevenson of University of Virginia, and he followed him around and sort of reported on his cases. And when I heard about these cases, real cases that this real scientist was undertaking, it kind of blew my mind. He was collecting data from these little children all over the world who, from the time they could speak, seemed to have like concrete information and sort of attachment to these other people. And they would say, you know, this was my name. I lived here. This is how I died. These were my parents' names. And the professor and his colleagues would go out in the field, collect this long list of statements that these little kids have made, and sort of try to find the people they seem to remember being. And in about 3,000 cases, they found somebody who had lived and died who fit this description. They fit a number of these statements. And then they would take these little kids to these places, and the kids could identify people and places and, you know, actual, you know, oh, that was my uncle, or we used to live here, but there used to be a door here, you know, and things that sort of seem to hold up. And so all of hearing about these cases really kind of opened a door in my mind. I was like, wow, this is incredible and so compelling. And the kind of novelist part of my mind started percolating. I had little kids at that point, and I was like, oh, wow, what would it be like for me if one of my kids was sort of saying, no, you're not my mom. This other person is my mom. Like, I don't want you. I want this other person. You know, and also I had two children, and they're so different. And I started to think, why are our kids different? Why are siblings so different? Like, same parents, you know, but one of them's afraid of this and one of them's drawn to that. And it just started me thinking, well, maybe that's why, you know. So I just kind of got really obsessed with this idea and kind of motivated to try to make up my own story and imagine myself in the mix of it all. And also I thought it might be useful for people to hear about these cases.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. I mean, you were intrigued and super curious about this research that Dr. Stevenson did, and so you write this novel, but do you have like a definitive opinion now about reincarnation?
Dr. Stevenson and his colleague, Dr. Tucker, don't work with adults at all, which is fascinating, because adults, of course, can know things from all sorts of places. But if you're talking about a 3-year-old child who just spontaneously says, I used to live in this village, and, you know, this was my teacher, and this is my blue house, and, you know, and they know all these things. How could they know these things? Sometimes, you know, there's this word xenoglossy, which is a very fancy word, but basically kids will speak in dialect from a place far from where they live. And the people around them in the villages don't know what they're saying. And the dialect fits with words from other places. I started just kind of curious and interested in these cases. My mind was pretty blown by them. But I, you know, I guess maybe I'm a New Yorker or whatever. I try to be not gullible. I try to be like, okay, let's just explore it. And it's good for a novel. And that's how I started. But then, you know, over the years, kind of reading about them, getting to know one of these researchers, Dr. Tucker, who's now taken over for Dr. Stevenson, just spending time sort of steeping my mind in these ideas and these thoughts and hearing from others after the book came out, I have to sort of ask myself at various points, well, do I think this is true? What do I think? And early on, it was like, well, it doesn't matter what I think. I'm just writing, making up a story. Mm-hmm. And then by the end, it was like, I think this is true. I believe in this. These cases are so compelling. There's no other really good answer for them. I mean, people have come up with kind of ideas about what it could be, but none of them are as likely as that they're true. And so that's an interesting thing to start to think about.
You started out as a skeptic, which many of us do, and then you had enough data that made you feel like, wow, this is a very real possibility, if not completely true. So you consider yourself a Buddhist, is that correct?
It's interesting because I did not identify myself as a Buddhist at all when I started writing this book. I was kind of doing little bits and pieces of I'll read a little of that, I'll read a little of this, do some meditation here and there based on whatever audio I stumbled across. And that was useful for me for sure, but I didn't have a regular meditation practice and I really, to be honest, haven't thought about it so deeply to have come to any conclusion for myself. But after deciding that I did believe in this, then of course that opens the door to, well, now what? You know, and in my case, and I think this is a very private, sort of personal thing, you know, I know all sorts of people have different kind of responses and beliefs in reincarnation. It takes them wherever it takes them. But for me, it sort of said, well, I need to kind of know more about what this means for me. I started then on a spiritual path that has led to identifying myself as a Buddhist and believing in sort of the idea that how we, you know, use our minds and in this life might affect our next life. So let's try to use them in the best possible way, you know.
So the writing of the book and the research that you were doing as you were writing the book really spurred on your curiosity. And you went to Buddhism to try and find answers, would you say? How did these things all to come together in your sort of worldview on the topic?
Well, I think that's interesting you use the word analytical because I think very much so my whole background, my academic background, I was always sort of a bit analytical, you know, English major, analyzing things. And so when I started this process, again, it was like, oh, okay, I'm writing a book, so I do research. So here's the research. And it was really all about the head. And even though I had kind of meditated a little bit, I didn't really understand what I was doing, I guess, in a way, or I never really got beyond the sort of surface level of intense chatter that my mind creates. And so part of the interesting process for me, and it was also through the process of writing a novel that's a very emotional novel in the end, you know, where you're empathizing with characters who are going through real, you know, extreme emotional states at various points. Like I kind of had to shift to, I don't know, as we talk about often in Buddhism, like the mind at your heart, you know, and that was a big shift for me, both in the writing of the book and in my life and in sort of following a spiritual path to sort of realize, oh, there's deeper levels of my mind. It's not just this chattering analytical topsoil. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I go deeper and that's where like sort of all the good stuff is. And that's what I can cultivate in terms of even the compassion that I had to sort of find in order to write this book, because I wasn't even sure as I was going about it. There's so many different characters that I had to sort of empathize with. And I had to ask myself, I'm a debut author, like, can I go there? Can I do this? And I think as I kept moving in my process to sort of a deeper place and a more heart-based place, it sort of allowed me to kind of cultivate a more compassionate mind and sort of certainly begin to sort of have a more peaceful approach to everything. I mean, I'm still very much at the beginning of all of this, but I've tasted it, you know, which is nice, because then you're like, I think I need more of that.
I really like the way you talk about like the topsoil being kind of the chatter in your mind and then getting into these deeper levels, more heart-based, more compassionate ways. Do you think, is that what you're saying? You were writing from a deeper level because you were meditating and studying Buddhist philosophy?
Yes, I guess. I mean, you know, there's a book, or at least my book has had many different kind of incarnations itself because, you know, I wrote it a bunch of times. I sold it. Then I rewrote it a bunch of times. And so by the last version, I had started practicing. I had started thinking about the sort of basic Buddhist ideas and meditating more deeply. I think one of the basic ideas in Buddhism is like, we're all suffering and we all want to be happy. And so it allows you to kind of get into the characters more deeply because everybody is in the same state in a way, unless you've managed to find your way out of the suffering.
I felt like all of your characters, whether they were kind of quote unquote good or bad, there were redeeming qualities in all of them that you could connect with. I thought that was such a beautiful part of the book. Why did the Brooklyn mom cause you the most angst of all of the characters?
I mean, it is a funny question because I'm a Brooklyn mom, so you'd think that that might be the easiest character to sort of get inside the head of. But I think that's the reason, actually. I think that I conceived that character as a little too similar to me. And she was always inside her head too much and in some ways wasn't so likable, which hopefully doesn't reflect upon me. And certainly, you know, there are aspects to her strong connection to her son and her willingness to kind of do anything for him that I totally relate to and that I could just kind of go right into imaginatively. But I needed her to be a separate person. And so it took a while.
When you say that she was really inside her head and that maybe you're inside your head a lot, like, what does that mean? How do you articulate that?
That's a good question. I think, well, in terms of the character, I would just have pages of just all these thoughts that she was having, as opposed to thoughts that were relating to what was happening around her more directly, you know? So it was just like some huge, like if it were a graphic novel or cartoon, there'd just be this enormous thought bubble, you know? And I think I became a little too comfortable with just having her ramble on and her thoughts. I do think that for myself, I mean, it's interesting. I've often thought that, you know, having children was very helpful for me because I was, you know, one of these people who was sort of just barely in her body, just constantly kind of absorbed in various, you know, lines of thinking. And having children kind of forced me to be in the present a lot more and relate because, you know, you've got to respond to a little kid and even an older kid. You know, or you want to respond. I mean, my kids are older now, and I suppose they'd be happy just being on screens all the time. And if I could just be in my own la-la land all the time, but that's not what we want. So I think a little bit of that came out in the character, and I had to sort of pull back. And certainly it's something that I still work with in terms of, you know, really having to focus on being as present as possible.
It sort of strikes me when you talk about like this thought bubble, I love that image and these pages and pages of thoughts that are in her head and I'm imagining in your head too. And I'm curious, how does your meditation practice help you with that big thought bubble? Because that's kind of, we talk about that as our monkey mind. And I'm just curious as a writer.
A word from our sponsor, Happy Mammoth. This is the company that created the amazing supplement Hormone Harmony, and they are dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients like herbal extracts called adaptogens that help the body adapt to any stressors, especially those chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. They're offering our listeners 15% off the first order at happymammoth.com using the promo code UNTANGLE. So if you're tired of hot flashes, night sweats, low moods, poor sleep, you get the drill. The things that put your life on hold, you will want to check them out. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com with the code UNTANGLE at checkout. That's happymammoth.com with the code UNTANGLE. Now, on to Untangle. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health, mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, www.forgettingtime.com/untangle. Now over to Untangle.
How that practice helps you.
Monkey mind just, you know, says it really well, I think. And I think that, you know, I would say having children and meditation are the two things that sort of saved me from just being like an uber monkey mind a lot of the time. Yeah, it's, you know, because in meditation, what you're becoming aware of is all of these thoughts, and you kind of watch them, you know, you see them go by. Oh, wow, I'm thinking this. Oh, there's that one again. Oh, and there's that one again. And you sort of learn that they're not you. For me, it was such an important lesson. A lot of them were anxious, to be honest, and anxious thoughts are pretty much useless. They have no nutritional value at all. They don't help anybody ever. So just worrying about things that you can't control, or even things that you can control, but you're not actually making actions, right? You're just worrying. Just used to take up a lot of mental space. And at a certain point, I was like, okay, there's the worry thought again, but that's not me. Mm-hmm. I don't have to identify myself with it at all. Especially in terms of writing, I think that's so important because there's a lot of thoughts, you know, around the process of writing. Basically, is this good enough? Am I good enough? Does this stink? Do I stink? Why am I doing this anyway? Is anyone going to read it? It's not useful for me to think those thoughts. And, you know, you just kind of develop a little distance from it.
Let's talk about how the writing of this book in particular has changed you as a person.
It's changed me a lot. You know, it's been a really interesting process. I started writing it really just to write a book on an interesting topic. And I knew that the cases were extraordinary and that I had an intention that people might hear about them. But I hadn't absorbed the fact that what I was hoping the readers would get from it, which is to kind of really place their minds in a world in which maybe reincarnation is real. And maybe we've lived before. Maybe our kids have had other mothers and other parents. Like, I wanted the readers to get that. But somehow it took a while before I realized that myself writing the book was, you know, I also needed to absorb that. I wasn't just sort of doing the providing this function. I was also going through that process. You know, once I started to realize that I was believing these things, especially since, you know, as I think I've mentioned, Dr. Stevenson and Tucker seemed enormously credible to me. It changed my view of what my goals were in life, of the really big picture. I think I started to think, okay, well, if you really think that you've been born before and you're going to be born again, then how do you really want to live? And how do you really want to live the most kind of positive, influential life for your next life and for everybody? You know, because it's more than just like, oh, maybe we've been born before and we live again. It's like a whole picture, right? It's a whole like, wow, things are really different than how we're just kind of leading our lives. I need to really take that into account in almost a molecular way if I can, or at least try to remind myself as often as possible that I'm not just on this little track of like, oh, when I try to do my work and be successful and get my kids into good schools. And it's really caused me to explore a spiritual path and caused me to think very differently about things.
When you talk about exploring a spiritual path, so that's different from before you started writing this book. And are you thinking about karma? Is that really what you're focused on, wanting to have good karma for your next life?
So, I mean, that's a part of it. You know, I think I always felt, though, I wanted to be a good person. And essentially, karma is just telling you, yeah, that's a good idea to be a good person. But it's also starting to realize, for instance, there's more, I would say more out there, also like more in there, the different states of being are possible. I sort of meditated from now and then before I started the book, but I didn't really have a regular practice. I didn't really follow any kind of path that you would say is anything but like, oh, here, you know, let me do this today. And so starting to have a regular practice and realizing just getting the like merest taste of like a different way of being that felt more peaceful, that felt kind of more connected, you know, it's just like the door's just slightly opened and you get a peek at something that's really extraordinary. So I guess that's the best I can describe it.
What is your thought on how we can each have an impact on the level of suffering in ourselves and in the world? Do you think that there's something that you've learned that would help us with that?
That's a very good question. First of all, I'll say that I think there's a direct connection between lowering the suffering of ourselves and lowering the suffering of the world. That might not be completely obvious, but I really do believe that as we become more connected to others and less bound to these ideas of ourselves that make us so miserable, we're sort of just more capable of change, of making change, of creating positive change in many, many ways. I think it's this shift away from these ideas of who we are connected to our unhappy thoughts that really, for me, has begun to give me much more freedom. Because it's, you know, I think before it's like I had a lot of, as I said, a lot of anxious thoughts. So I just was like, I'm an anxious person and that's it. And other people, the same with anger or jealousy or whatever it is. And this is also, you know, a kind of a Buddhist concept as well. That's just a self that you've created that doesn't really exist beyond a thought in your mind, that anxious self, that angry self, that it's your thoughts that are creating this and that you can learn how to let those thoughts go. This has definitely been true for me. As I said, I'm a work in progress. Sometimes I'll get into a funk, of course. And then when I start to sort of remember and get a little awareness, oh, you know, why am I in a funk? Oh, I'm creating my funk because these things happen that cause me to have, you know, jealous thoughts or anxious thoughts or whatever it is. And to just slightly kind of step away from that and just sort of see that process and just sort of say, okay, well, I know what that is. Like, I know very well what that is.
Yeah, I love the way you say that because I think it's a skill that we all can learn and it helps to manage these fluctuations and kind of variations in our lives that happen when we're not in control, which we're not. So
exactly.
There's a quote about your book that the author of Orphan Train wrote, and it says, "What if what you did mattered more because life happened again and again? Consequences unfolding across decades and continents, a relentlessly paced page turner and a profound meditation on the meaning of life."
She was being very kind.
Why do you think this became an international bestseller and it really captured our interest in these themes of reincarnation and life? And to have this book be considered, you know, a meditation on the meaning of life, that's a big deal.
But I think a lot of people aren't going to pick up those books, frankly, you know, so easily. Like, well, you know, if you're not really sure that you're very interested in reincarnation, are you going to go to the store and buy a book called, you know, Extraordinary Stories of Children, you know, Return to Life, Extraordinary Stories of Children Who Remember Past Lives? But many people, that's just not the way they're thinking. So I think they come across it almost, I don't know, the word that came to mind was innocently. Like they just think it, oh, it's a good read. I'll check it out. And then, you know, it has the sort of research built in there and the concept in there. And I think that it's a universal situation that we're going to die and we don't know what's happening next. And there are different theories and different data about what might happen next. And for some reason, we don't explore that, at least in our culture very much. Here's sort of an opportunity to kind of really explore that in a way that feels safe, in a way that feels like you don't need to decide anything. You're just opening your mind to the possibility of it while you're going along for the ride on this story.
Does death scare you, or do you feel like you have a different perspective on death now? And maybe you can share some of your thoughts on our perspectives on death in general in our culture.
I wouldn't say death scares me. I would say that I very much want to have as long a life as possible because there's a lot I want to do, both, you know, raising my children and writing more books and spiritually making progress. So that would be nice to live a longer life. But I'm also not terrified of it. I think before I started this process of writing this book and thinking about it differently, I kind of had a thought like, it'll happen and probably be okay. I don't even know what I meant by that in my mind, but like, I guess it'll be okay, or maybe it'll be okay. And of course, I really had to think about death a lot more through the process of writing this book and working with this data about people who die and they're reborn as children, who in some cases are somewhat haunted by their mode of death. If you meditate and you work on training your mind to kind of try to get to a peaceful place, the hope is that no matter what's happening, you can sort of get to that peaceful place. So that's kind of my personal feelings about it. I do feel that our society really doesn't do death very well at all. I think we don't talk about it. We fight it till the very last minute. Even when we know someone is going to die, we're trying to get them another week or maybe even another couple of hours. And so people are spending the remainder of their time kind of in total resistance to what's happening to them. And I think, you know, the hospice movement has been wonderful at sort of coming in and sort of saying, we're about making you comfortable, you know, helping you to have a positive experience here, helping your family, and not about sort of resistance to what's happening, because it's going to happen for all of us. And we don't give people the space to sort of feel the kind of peace and love that will be the best for them and for their families as they're sort of going through the end of this process. You know, I think that's important, and I hope we sort of move more in that direction.
Well, you definitely struck a chord. So many people have just been raving about this book and talking about it and sharing their own stories. So, you know, I want to thank you so much for writing the book and for opening up this conversation for us to be able to share with one another. So, and thank you for being on the show today, Sharon. I really appreciate your being here.
Thank you so much. I loved your questions, and it was just a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much to Sharon for joining us on Untangle. You can find The Forgetting Time at all major booksellers. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio in the App Store or on Google Play. We'll see you next week.